What if the biggest money laundering operations in the world aren't happening in, you know, shadowy back alleys, but right out in the open, disguised as completely boring, everyday corporate paperwork?
It's a pretty chilling thought, honestly.
Right. Like, we tend to picture financial crime like a heist movie. Clandestine midnight meetings, physical smuggling, that sort of thing. But what if the perfect crime looks exactly like a stack of standard import invoices just sitting on a banker's desk?
Well, when you look at modern large-scale financial crime, the most effective weapon isn't a getaway car. I mean, it is a fabricated commercial document.
Wow.
Yeah. The perpetrators, they aren't bypassing the system. They are actively weaponizing the system's own rules against it.
Welcome to our deep dive. The reason we are jumping to this today is because a massive stack of leaked documents and undercover footage from the 2023 Al Jazeera Gold Mafia investigation just completely pulled back the curtain.
It really did.
It exposed how these commodity laundering networks are operating across Southern Africa, East Africa, the UAE, and other massive global financial hubs. So our mission today for you, the listener, is to unpack what these sources call a value conversion system.
Right, which sounds technical, but it's fascinating.
It really is. We are going to explore how illicit cash, fake trade documents, offshore companies, and compromised bank insiders all converge to turn dirty money into pristine, legitimate wealth.
It's honestly a masterclass in exploiting the very infrastructure of legitimate global finance, because to understand the architecture of the system, we have to look past the sensational elements. You have to focus on the mundane logistics of moving criminal proceeds at an industrial scale.
And the scale is really the driving force here, right? Because before we even get to the gold, which is obviously the glamorous part of this scheme, we have to look at the source of the funds.
Right. Where does the dirty money actually come from?
Exactly. I mean, you listening to this know that moving a few thousand dollars of illicit cash is, well, it's pretty easy. But the investigation into one of the major alleged South African networks points to a source that generates literally pallets of physical currency. Illicit cigarettes.
Yeah, the economics of tobacco smuggling are just staggering. We are talking about a product that can be manufactured entirely legally, but then, you know, it gets diverted.
It just falls off the back of a truck, basically.
Essentially, yeah. It's underdeclared at borders, smuggled or sold domestically without the required excise and tax payments.
Those pure profit margin.
Exactly. You have massive established distribution networks, highly inelastic demand, and a huge price arbitrage between the taxed market and the untaxed market.
So they are sitting on physical mountains of illicit cash.
Literal mountains of it, yeah.
It's kind of like winning the lottery, but you can't tell the tax man. You have all this cash, but how do you buy a luxury estate or like a fleet of cargo ships with duffel bags of small bills without the authorities knocking on your door?
Yeah, you can't. That's the integration problem. You need a mechanism to integrate hundreds of millions of dollars into the formal economy simultaneously.
Right. And the solution, according to the investigation into a network associated with businessman Mohammed Khan, who is known as Mo Dollars, and a Zimbabwean tobacco entrepreneur named Simon Rudland, was trade-based money laundering.
Yeah, TBML. Yep.
They allegedly moved this cash using companies connected with financial services and offshore commerce, backed by entirely fabricated invoices.
And the mechanics of that are so crucial to understand. My reading of the sources is they would claim to be importing everyday goods, things like tobacco, clothing, textiles.
But the underlying goods never actually entered South Africa as declared, right?
Exactly.
Wait, so they just type up a fake invoice for like t-shirts, hand it to a bank, and the bank just wires millions of dollars to an account in Mauritius or Switzerland, just based on a piece of paper.
Yes. That vulnerability is called document dependence. You really have to look at how international trade finance actually functions in the real world.
Okay, how so?
Well, a bank processing foreign exchange transactions isn't a logistics company. They don't have personnel down at the port opening up shipping containers to check for t-shirts.
Right, they're just looking at screens?
Exactly. They look at the paperwork. They see an established corporate customer. They see an invoice from an offshore supplier. And they see a commercially plausible commodity description.
So to the clearing bank, a PDF invoice for $10 million of t-shirts looks totally identical to a legitimate transaction. Because, I mean, millions of real t-shirts are imported every single day.
Right. It blends right in. The transaction passes right through the formal banking system because the commercial documentation provides this veneer of absolute legitimacy.
Wow.
Unless the institution is cross-referencing that invoice against live shipping data or you know, testing whether the pricing is commercially reasonable, which historically they just haven't done the funds move offshore. They're over-invoicing, under-invoicing, or just phantom shipments.
I want to pause here for a quick second. As we get deeper into the mechanics of this value conversion system, I need to explicitly state for you, the listener, that we are discussing allegations originating from investigative reporting.
That's an important distinction, yeah.
Simon Rudland categorically denied all the allegations, describing them as a coordinated smear campaign. The banks involved also stated they would investigate, cooperate with authorities, or take action where misconduct was established. So we aren't here to play judge and jury. We are just impartially analyzing the mechanics of a specific methodology detailed in the sources.
And analyzing that typology is vital because, well, faking invoices for consumer goods like t-shirts has a hard ceiling.
What do you mean?
If a relatively unknown shell company is suddenly importing $1 billion worth of clothing, the volume alone is going to trigger anti-money laundering algorithms. It just looks ridiculous.
Ah, okay. So to move billions, you need a commodity that is incredibly dense in value.
Exactly. Which is where gold enters the picture.
Right. Gold seems like the ultimate laundering tool. It functions almost like a sort of offline physical cryptocurrency. It holds massive, universally recognized value, but you can move it entirely outside the formal banking system.
It really is perfect for professional money launderers. It possesses this very rare combination of traits. It's both a commodity and a highly recognized store of value. It's portable. It's easily divisible.
You can break it into bars, jewelry, whatever.
Right. And crucially, its physical form can be altered to erase its entire history.
You mean melting it down?
Exactly. You take unrefined doré, which is basically a semi-pure gold alloy straight from a mine or even scrap jewelry, and you just throw it in a crucible, melt it down, recast it into new bars.
So the chemical signature might still be there, but the commercial history is entirely vaporized.
Vaporized. Once it's recast, you can easily substitute the documents describing its weight, purity, and origin.
I'm thinking about how this interacts with those fake invoices we discussed earlier. By using the dirty cash to buy physical gold, the network crosses what we could call an asset boundary.
Oh, that's a great term for it.
Yeah, they no longer hold dirty currency, right? They hold a recognized physical asset.
And that distinction is everything in this system. A multi-million-dollar cross-border payment for precious metals doesn't raise the same red flags as a massive invoice for low-value consumer goods.
Because gold justifies massive payments.
Right. And more importantly, once the network holds the gold, it can be exported to another jurisdiction, say a major trading hub in the Middle East or Europe, and then it gets sold into an apparently legitimate market.
So when they sell it, the wire transfer they receive in return isn't dirty cigarette money anymore.
Not at all.
It's booked as 100% legitimate, clean revenue from a legal commodity export. It's like the gold acts as a massive value sponge. It absorbs the illicit cash and just squeezes out clean, verifiable revenue.
It completely disconnects the criminal proceeds from their origin. And this relies heavily on what we call the fragmented vision problem in global trade.
Fragmented vision?
Yeah, the supply chain literally blinds the authorities. The laundering process spans multiple jurisdictions. The gold might be acquired in one country, exported through a second, refined in a third, and sold in a fourth.
And nobody is looking at the whole chessboard.
Exactly. Customs authorities only see a declared export. The bank only sees the payment instructions.
The refiner just sees metal presented by a supplier.
Right. And the final buyer just receives certified clean gold. Every participant only verifies their tiny little sliver of the transaction. Without cross-border information sharing, nobody sees the big picture.
But wait, even with gold's density and the illusion of legitimate trade documents, moving money at this massive scale has to eventually trip a bank's automated transaction monitoring, doesn't it? I mean, you can't run billions through correspondent banks without an algorithm flagging the velocity or destination of those funds.
Which brings us to perhaps the most alarming aspect of the South African allegations, the neutralization of those very algorithms from the inside.
The compromised insiders.
Yes. The investigation accused employees at major institutions, specifically Sasfin Bank, Absa, and Standard Bank, of actively assisting the network.
See, my initial thought when reading that was the classic cinematic trope, like a compliance officer getting a briefcase full of unmarked cash in a dark parking garage.
Right, like something out of a spy movie.
Yeah. But looking at the source material, the bribery typology is much more insidious and, frankly, structural.
It rarely looks like a movie in real life. The ledgers uncovered in the investigation allegedly showed that influence was bought through things like recurring localized payments, all expenses paid holidays, and property improvements.
Wow, property improvements.
Yeah. In financial crime, bribery often takes the form of debt repayment or heavily discounted assets or even lucrative consulting contracts provided to a banker's relative.
It's quiet.
Very quiet.
And it gives the laundering network a terrifying advantage. I mean, an external criminal has to figure out how to structure their transactions to slip past the bank's security perimeter. But a compromised insider doesn't have to trick the system.
No, they just use their legitimate login credentials to turn it off. Or approve the exception.
That is wild.
Compliance professionals call this key person risk or control system multipliers.
Okay, break that down for me.
Well, you don't need to corrupt the bank's executive board to move dirty money. You only need a few insiders performing very narrow, specific tasks.
Like who?
Like a relationship manager who knows the exact threshold that triggers a source of wealth inquiry. So they structure the client's onboarding documents to sit just below it.
Or a foreign exchange operator reviewing a flagged cross-border wire. They can simply categorize it as a false positive in the internal software, citing some pre-approved trade rationale.
Exactly. They know the specific logic of the alert systems. A handful of compromised employees doing very narrow tasks can collectively neutralize the entire institution's due diligence and transaction monitoring, blinding the bank to the billions flowing right through it.
So once a documentary like this airs and exposes a system like this, what actually happens? Transitioning from television allegations to actual legal and regulatory consequences takes years. What was the real-world fallout?
The sources outline a massive reaction, starting internally with the banks themselves, though it's important to note the distinct difference between a corporate response and a judicial finding.
Right.
APSA stated they referred the information to their forensic investigators. Standard Bank dismissed an employee named in the documentary following an internal disciplinary process.
And SASFIN.
SASFIN reported that they dismissed employees connected with misconduct in their foreign exchange business and actually laid criminal complaints.
But the consequences expanded far beyond internal HR dismissals, right?
Okay.
The South African Revenue Service, SARS, launched a massive civil summons against SASFIN in December 2023.
A huge one, yes.
For approximately 5.3 billion rand. They went after the bank itself, alleging it had wrongfully assisted taxpayers in unlawfully moving undeclared funds offshore.
And SASFIN strongly disputed liability there. They challenged the legal basis of the claim. The trajectory of that lawsuit gives us a really good window into how slow and procedural civil litigation is in these matters.
Yeah, it's not an instant criminal conviction.
Not at all. In November 2025, the High Court delivered a judgment that was highly technical.
From my reading of that ruling, the judge basically said the bank doesn't owe a direct private law duty to the taxman in the way a private citizen might, which upheld one of SASFIN's objections.
Right, but they did allow an alternative statutory claim under broader financial sector laws to proceed.
So the battle is far from over.
Exactly. It just highlights the immense difficulty of translating systemic compliance failures into direct financial liability in a courtroom. The state has to prove not just that the laundering occurred, but that the institution's specific failures directly caused the state's financial loss under the strict letter of the law.
And this wasn't just isolated to South Africa. We have to broaden the scope here. The sources detail a sprawling global regulatory crackdown. In December 2024, the U.S. and the U.K. deployed severe sanctions, targeting 28 individuals and entities connected to a Zimbabwe-based gold smuggling ring led by Kamlesh Patni.
And sanctions cascade through the global financial system instantly, but enforcing them requires banks to do incredibly complex mapping.
What do you mean by mapping?
Well, when the U.S. Treasury designates an individual, a bank can't just run a surface-level search for the name Kamlesh Patni and block those specific accounts.
Because professional laundering networks operate through layers of proxies.
Exactly. The banks have to look past the names and analyze beneficial ownership trees. They have to identify relatives, trusted associates, and offshore front companies that don't carry the designated person's name at all, but act on their behalf.
Oh, wow. So if a bank processes a U.S. dollar transaction for a shell company that's secretly owned by a sanctioned entity, they get hit.
They face massive fines from U.S. regulators, regardless of whether they actively knew who the true owner was.
That is intense.
Yeah.
And the macro impact on South Africa as a jurisdiction was just as severe. In February 2023, the Financial Action Task Force, the global money laundering watchdog, placed South Africa on its gray list for increased monitoring.
That label acts like a financial chokehold.
Really? How bad is it?
It signals to the global correspondent banking network, you know, the massive institutions in New York or London, that clear U.S. dollars and euros, that a country's internal controls are structurally compromised. Suddenly, every cross-border transaction coming out of South Africa required enhanced due diligence. The friction and the cost of doing international business just skyrocketed.
So South Africa had to implement a massive wave of legislative reforms across law enforcement, beneficial ownership tracking, all of that. And by October 2025, they actually managed to get officially removed from the gray list.
Which is a material institutional achievement.
But getting delisted just means you passed the legislative audit, right?
Yeah.
It doesn't mean the underlying criminal networks just evaporated.
Precisely. The FATF evaluates jurisdictions based on what they call sustainable effectiveness. Having the right laws on the books is just step one.
The real test is enforcement.
Exactly. Can the authorities continuously investigate these multi-jurisdictional networks? Can they successfully prosecute the professional facilitators, the lawyers, the accountants, the bankers? And can they actually confiscate the proceeds hidden in those offshore trusts?
So to summarize this bleak picture, if criminals have the perfect commodity in gold, and they have fake documents that look real, and they have compromised insiders turning off the alarms, how on earth does a modern financial institution actually fight back? If you're a financial crime leader listening to this, what is the solution?
The sources outline a necessary shift toward what they call a resilient control stack.
Resilient control stack. Okay.
The core philosophy is moving away from the document dependence we discussed earlier and moving toward an evidence-led investigation model.
Meaning it's no longer enough to just check if an invoice exists and the math adds up.
Right. Institutions must validate the underlying trade data. If a customer is claiming to import $50 million of textiles, the bank's automated systems need to test that against current global market prices.
Make sure they aren't paying $1,000 for a basic t-shirt.
Exactly. And they need to integrate with external shipping databases to cross-reference customs declarations. Verify that the shipping container actually exists and was actually loaded onto the vessel listed on the invoice.
I can see the theoretical value there, but wait. Introducing that level of friction seems completely at odds with how the global economy functions.
Yeah.
If we force clearing banks to act as pseudo-customs agents, verifying the physical location of every single shipping container moving across the ocean, won't international trade finance just grind to a halt?
Well, you don't apply that level of friction to every single transaction.
Oh, okay.
The solution relies on targeted intelligence and network analysis. You aren't investigating single invoices in a vacuum. You are looking for behavioral discrepancies over time.
Looking for patterns.
Yes. You program the algorithms to flag rapid international transfers combined with opaque offshore ownership structures. You look for supposedly independent companies sharing the same directors or the same registered addresses or repeatedly using the same obscure logistics providers.
So you hunt for the network architecture rather than trying to catch individual fraudulent wires.
Exactly. And crucially, the resilient control stack requires aggressive internal auditing. It means monitoring employee integrity.
Watching the watchers.
Yes. Institutions have to deploy analytics on their own system access logs. You monitor which employees are consistently overriding controls or who is approving high-risk client exceptions outside of normal business hours.
To achieve that, you'd have to completely dismantle the internal silos within the bank.
You have to. The anti-money laundering team, the fraud department, the tax risk analysts, the cybersecurity teams, they can no longer operate in isolation. They have to combine their data. The strongest institutions ensure that high-value commodity trade is supported by verifiable physical goods, transparent corporate ownership, and employees whose internal decisions can actually withstand independent scrutiny.
Wow. We've covered a tremendous amount of ground today for you, the listener, pulling apart the mechanics of this value conversion system. We started with the sheer logistical nightmare of managing physical cash generated by industrial-scale tobacco smuggling.
Right.
We explored how trade-based money laundering attempts to solve that integration problem using fake clothing invoices, exploiting the banking sector's reliance on documents. We looked at how gold acts as the ultimate boundary-crossing asset, erasing the origins of dirty money through the physical melting process.
Yeah, that's a crucial step.
And we analyze how the entire architecture relies on the terrifying multiplier effect of compromised insiders, neutralizing security systems from within.
The complexity of the operation really just reflects the complexity of the global financial system itself. The vulnerabilities are baked into the speed and scale of modern commerce.
which leaves me with a final lingering thought for you to mull over. Throughout this entire deep dive, one underlying theme kept surfacing for me. Our modern global economy relies heavily on the foundational trust that documents, invoices, bills of lading, customs declarations are an accurate representation of physical reality. We trust the paperwork.
We do.
But if a highly sophisticated laundering network can essentially fabricate an entire parallel economy on paper, and the internal systems designed to catch them can't tell the difference without playing detective, does the modern global economy actually run on verifiable facts? Or does it merely run on the illusion of convincing paperwork? Next time you're driving past a massive port facility and you look up at those towering stacks of shipping containers, you have to wonder, is that container full of goods or is it just full of alibis? Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. We'll catch you next time.